The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Yo, 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 welcome once again to the Kiefer and Curry Show. It's a show we do every single week right here on Tony Curry Radio. Thanks to thousands of folks who have downloaded that TKR app. Listen every week. Of course, you can hear this show, Kiefer and Curry, at least five times during the week. We do fresh shows every single week. Better yet, go back and listen. I think we've done about six or seven shows already. Great topics. We do a little bit of a different show here, not necessarily topical stuff, but we let Kip and, of course, myself, Tony, kind of get deep on some things that are important to us. And today, Kip, first of all, you doing good? Everything good?
Hey, man, I couldn't be better. Thanks.
All right, I'm going to do my best job not to choke during the show today, because that's what we're, that's what we're talking about, baby. And there have been two things recently that happened in my life, including that Boston Bruins game the other night that made me want to go this route. But in sports, choking is the failure of a person or persons to act or behave as anticipated or expected. And so we're not only going to do our favorite or biggest chokes, four of them in our lives, but not necessarily have to be sports chokes. And I'm going to let you go ahead and fire off your first one here. I have a feeling that I hope we're going to have four different ones. I think we're going to be okay.
Yeah, I've got a couple. I mean, I just thinking about it, I didn't even have to do any research. I came up with about seven or eight right off the bat. So I have an inventory of spares. All right. But I have to say that unquestionably to me, the greatest choke of all time, fitting your definition, what you just laid out about not living up to expectations, was a golf event. And we talked about the Masters recently, but the 1996 Masters, Greg Norman, considered the greatest player in the world, the great white shark from Australia, went to the first tee on Sunday at the Masters with a six-stroke lead. It was all but over. It was in the books. It was an insurmountable advantage over Nick Faldo, who had already won a couple of Masters in the previous 5 years, but he was hopelessly behind six-back. Norman had stomped him throughout the week. And at the end of the day, Tony, not only did Greg Norman not hold on to his six-stroke lead, Greg Norman was beaten by the end of the day by Nick Faldo by five strokes. That was an 11-stroke swing. Nick Faldo shot a 67. Greg Norman, the greatest player in the world, swashbuckling, fearless, could knock down any shot, could make any putt. Greg Norman shot something that you and I may have come close to matching, a 78 in the final round of the Masters. In my mind, in sports, in life, in anything else, there has never been a greater choke than Greg Norman's, who to this day acknowledges that he just mentally just kind of lost it and was thinking about all the implications of what winning the Masters was going to mean to his career and how much it meant to him. And it completely got him out of his game. And I think it's the very graphic definition of a choke that every year, how sick does that guy have to be when the champions dinner happens before each Masters, all the winners get together for a big event and wear their green jackets. Greg not only has no green jacket in his closet, he doesn't have an invite to Augusta for that event.
That is a great choke. I saw that choke. I wanted to go with that choke. I knew you'd probably go with that choke because I knew you were a golfer guy, so I left it alone. You know, what's really interesting, too, about chokes, too, is what's a bigger choke, when it's an individual choke or when it's a team choke? Because you almost feel like if it's an individual choke, he's the only one that can control what's going to happen. And so if he's out and you're shooting a 78 the last day of the Masters, you almost kind of say, you know, some days you just don't have it. When you have a team choke, which is what we saw with the Boston Bruins the other night, that's where I'm like, wow, this is a major. You're talking about a team that set the Major Hockey League record for wins. They set the Major Hockey League in points, in 135 points. You had the swan song for Patrice Bergeron. This was supposed to be the way he was going to go out. He's going to win a Stanley Cup. I've got a little stat for you. Since 1984, the team who has won the most points and the most wins in the NHL since 1984 has won the Stanley Cup a total of eight times. It just doesn't happen. They call it the curse of the Stanley Cup, and it came back to bite the Boston Bruins this past weekend. The other thing I think is amazing, and of course I was going through a list and list and list of big chokes just to make sure that I was keeping my mind fresh on everything that's out there, because I thought maybe I missed something. I was looking through Major League Baseball, and I was looking through just everything. I realized the Boston Bruins, according to Bleacher Report, have four of sports 50 biggest chokes of all time. There are millions. There are millions of choke jobs. The Boston Bruins are one of the most chokingest teams in all of sports. But yeah, and to lose the way they did, first of all, 8:35 left in Game 7 at OT. You almost, I don't know if you watched the game, and I'm not a big hockey fan, but I will watch a Game 7 of pickleball. I will watch any Game 7 of anything, of cornhole. I'll watch a Game 7. I love Game 7s. And I'm sitting there watching it, and I knew the minute it went OT, I'm like, they're going to lose. And you got this Florida Panther team who didn't get into the playoffs until the second to the last day of the regular season.
Yes.
And they come in here and knock off this team that had 65 wins and 135 points.
That hockey hotbed of Miami. The irony is just so awesome, because the other thing to point out about that game the other night, the Bruins had a one-goal lead. They nursed for most of the third period after they scored twice early. And, of course, if people aren't familiar with hockey, you can pull your goalie and leave your net empty to put an extra attacker on the ice. That's what Florida did. You take the chance, you know, lose by one, lose by two. What difference does it make? But with the extra skater and just 59 seconds left in the game, Florida got the tying goal to send it into overtime. Yep. So the Boston fans already trying to celebrate what looked like it was a sure thing turned out to be anything but.
Well, let's remember Game 4, Boston wins 6-2. What are they up? They're up 3-1. They got 3 shots to win 1 game. They couldn't get it done. That's my first show. What's your next one?
I'm going to go in my next one. And again, I'm torn because I did want to have a couple of non-sports examples. So I'm gonna not spend a lot of time on the reasons, but I'll give you the basics, because I think I'm appalled that the Americans really don't seem to know their history anymore. I guess the main reason for that is we don't teach American history anymore. But I'm gonna call the second biggest joke. It's a three-way tie between various American military opponents, starting with the British in the Revolutionary War.
I love this.
Tony, the British had the most superior army in the world, had the biggest empire, had all the horses. The Americans had a bunch of yokels with squirrel rifles, no formal military training, a couple of officers, chiefly George Washington, and somehow, some way, the Americans beat the British, and the biggest choke in the Revolutionary War was George Washington hopelessly trapped with his entire force in New York, which the British occupied. And of course, the famous escape from that situation, going in the dead of night in total darkness, no lights, couldn't have those because it would have tipped off the forces, that they literally on the river snuck right by in the fog, in the dark, and evacuated his whole army, which turned the whole Revolutionary War around. The other recipients of this honor are Adolf Hitler and the Germans, who had everything going their way in World War II, but a simple dupe by the Allied forces and this is just unbelievable. It seems like it's too wild for even a movie. They got a corpse from London, a recently expired individual, and they cleaned him up and dressed him up in a military uniform and put some and created an identity for him and let him wash up on the Sicilian coast where the Germans were controlling at the time, supposedly with plans in his breast pocket for the great invasion that became Normandy, but pointing it toward the northern part of France in Calais. The Germans found this body, bought it hook, line, and sinker. I guess they verified this guy was legitimate because they had created an identity for him, and a corpse basically won World War II because Hitler amassed all of his forces basically in Calais, 200 miles from Normandy, where the great invasion on D-Day happened. And of course, the Allied forces prevailed in horrendous fighting on that beach and began the trek toward Berlin and the end of World War II. So nice choke, Adolf. Good decision there. You were bested by a ruse of a dead guy. And the third one is in the Pacific during the same time, we had the Japanese in complete control of that deal. The Americans tricked them into attacking Midway by transmitting obvious messages that the Japanese would decode, that there was a problem with the fresh water supply there, and they were taking troops and personnel off of Midway Island. It lured the Japanese in with all of their big battleships, and through a couple of miraculous events, the Americans were able to pretty much destroy the entire Japanese attack force in the Pacific in the course of just a couple of days, mostly because the Japanese commanders, once they finally located one of the few remaining American battleships, which were, our fleet, of course, was heavily damaged previously, not only at Pearl Harbor, but in early engagements. And they had equipped all of their planes with torpedo bombs, which are, you know, major bombs that you drop off to destroy battleships. They actually, you know, hit the water and propel forward. But all of their planes on their biggest battleship were sitting on the deck ready to take off and attack when the Americans happened to come upon that force with a relatively small aerial group that bombarded those ships. And with those planes sitting ducks with their own explosives, created a massive amount more firepower because their own planes basically sunk their ships. So that was a big choke by the Japanese in calculation. So a three-way tie, the British, the Japanese, and the Germans, all major chokes. And Americans should be very appreciative of the fact that we had superior intelligence and the capability to make those chokes happen.
I can promise you that I would not have had that one. That's it. And I knew you'd give us some nice history, some military history during this big choke job of the Kiefer and Curry Show. You can hear it 5 days a week right here on the TKR app. Download the TKR app through Apple or Tony Curry Radio on Android. You can also listen to us wherever you get your podcasts. We're on all the major indices. Check us out. Look for Kiefer Curry or Tony Curry Radio. All right, I'm going to go to the sports one here. And you just gave me another one that I'm wondering if you're going to have that happened back in 2016 when it comes to politics. We'll get to that in a second. So I'm down in Guatemala in 2008, and this came to mind because this past March Madness, we had a team from Conference USA that was in the Final Four. And, of course, the Conference USA won the NIT, they won the CBA, and then I'm thinking to myself, how cool would it be to have a Conference USA win March Madness, because we're always fighting for that Cinderella, right? So FAU had this incredible run. Well, there was another team back in 2008 that was pretty good in Conference USA. That would be John Calipari's Memphis squad. Do you remember that team? I'm sitting down in Guatemala, and I'm down there adopting my second son. And, of course, in Guatemala, the night we picked him up from the U.S. Embassy, the NCAA basketball tournament was on. Thank goodness I had a sling box with me, because they have ESPN 1, 2, 3, and 4 down there in South America, and all four channels were on soccer on the night of the national championship. So I go back to the hotel room, and I'm watching Memphis and Kansas. And what was John Calipari's Memphis squad notorious for in that 2008 year? They could not make their free throws right before the game. And by the way, they shot 68.7% for the season, which was about roughly 10 percentage points below an average team in college hoops that year. 69% is nothing to sneeze at, but it's certainly not going to win you championships. And he was asked the question, if it gets down to the nitty gritty, what are you going to do about your free throw shooting? And he said, and I quote, "We'll make our free throws when we need to make our free throws." Well, here we are with 2 minutes and 12 seconds left. By the way, Memphis was actually favored by 2 in that game. You were feeling really good about yourself being up 9 with 2 minutes and 12 seconds left. You know they're going to start fouling, and John said they're going to make their free throws. Well, they shoot 63% in the game. They miss 4 of their last 5 free throws. And, of course, Kansas hits the three-pointer at the end of the game because of OT, and they end up winning by 7 points. And really, I can make it right. I'm not a John Calipari fan. I realize that I think he's 14th overall in all wins. He is certainly a Hall of Famer. He's been at Kentucky and has only won one national title since 2009. That's in 14 years. You don't bring John Calipari and pay him the money. And all he was the original one and done guy. You don't bring a guy in to win one stinking championship in 14 years. He's won one national title in his entire career. That his career, to me, is a choke job. Kentucky fans say they love him. I don't get it. I think it's like a lot of Louisville fans used to say they love Denny Crum. I don't get it. I don't understand it. I think Kentucky feels like they've got a woman who's adaptable. She can change. She can get breast augmentation. She can get Botox. She can blow her lips up whenever she wants. But is she really the woman you want? I don't think Kentucky fans really want John Calipari, but I think they still think that every single year they have a shot until they lose to a St. Peter's in the first round. So I'm going to go a multiple choke job here on John Calipari, but certainly that chance to put Conference USA on the map with Memphis. And of course, it seemed like he was a perennial Final Four guy. They were 30-4. They were 16-0 in Conference USA. To be up 9 with 2 minutes and 12 seconds left and lose that game to the eventual champion Kansas, the biggest I remember in college hoops.
Yeah, my oldest son, Tony, was a senior at Kansas, journalism major, editor of the sports for the student paper. And he was at the press table courtside for that game, covering it for KU. And that was a glorious moment in his college career and his memories. Of course, Case now is a really rising rapidly star in Las Vegas, sports editor for the Las Vegas Sun. But that was a fond memory in the Kiefer family. And in fact, he was not able to be at the national championship game last year in New Orleans. But my youngest son and I, who are converted Kansas basketball fans because of Case's experience, we made the trek to New Orleans and were on hand to see another national championship last year against North Carolina.
Nice. All right, what's your third one, man?
Okay, I'm going to go to probably the biggest football choke that I ever witnessed. And it was back in 2003. It was the Buffalo Bills hosting the Houston Oilers in the AFC championship game for a chance to go to the Super Bowl, another franchise that all their time in Houston just always dangled on the edge of getting to the big time, but never could get it done. What looked like under Warren Moon, it was finally going to happen on that day. At halftime, Tony, the score: Houston Oilers 35, Buffalo Bills 3. Mm-hmm. That was the score at halftime. Warren Moon and the Oilers did anything they wanted to do. Buffalo could do nothing. Jim Kelly, their quarterback, was injured. So Frank Reich, who's now an NFL coach, was the quarterback, kind of an obscure backup out of Maryland. They came out in the second half. Houston got away from doing everything they'd done in the first half, running the ball effectively. Moon couldn't complete a pass. They couldn't make a first down. Next thing you know, Buffalo's creeping back. It got to be like 35-20 in the fourth quarter, and you said, there's still no way. Well, there was a way. Buffalo rallied with a last-minute drive, tied the game at 35. Houston still, after getting 35 points in the first half, had done nothing in the second half and could do nothing. And Buffalo, in the overtime, wins the coin flip, goes down the field, kicks the field goal. Buffalo to the Super Bowl again. And the Houston Oilers fritter away a 35-3 lead in probably the greatest collapse in a team sport that I've ever witnessed. So I have to put them on my list.
And you remember I did a show with a guy named Aldo Greco who was on that football team. And
that's right.
We, you know, you're talking about a guy that not only lost that game, but he also lost, of course, the game against the Rams where they came up a yard and a half short. It was just, I mean, talk about two of the most brutal losses in your life. Whenever we brought it up, you could just see his face. The blood would just rush from his face. And it had been 20 years since that happened when I worked with him. And he was like, it was just unbelievable. And the thing is he's like, you know, when you've got the over in a particular game and you're watching the clock, it just flies by. When you got the under, it seems like there's three forever. Seconds for every second that goes. And he said, I just kept looking up at the clock and it was like 6:57. And he look up like 4 minutes later, it'd be 6:54. And he's like, what, how is this possible that this clock is going so stinking close? Because they were just playing prevent pretty much the entire second half until the point Well, they had to switch it on. It was too late. That is a great, great choke. And I hadn't even thought of that game. Fantastic. We're doing Kip Kiefer's and Tony Curry's Kiefer and Curry Show, biggest, best chokes this week here in the Kiefer and Curry Show. Thanks again for listening every single week. And of course, you can podcast this. And of course, if you have some great chokes, we'd love to get into them. Info@TonyCurryRadio.net. Info@TonyCurryRadio.net. All right. So I'm going to go back about 16 years ago, which was in, and I know you're into the gambling thing. There is a point in a season. I've seen it with the Yankees about 6-7 years ago. I've seen it with other teams where they cannot set the lines high enough. There's a team that's just absolutely on fire, and it's not week to week. It's month to month. You cannot set the lines high enough. In 2007, this football team, the last 10 games of the year in the National Football League, in the you just don't see the lines like this. 12.5. 13.5, 13.5, 13, 22, 21, 10.5, 19.5, 24, and 15.5. That were the last 10 games they played in the 2007 football season. That were the spreads. 24? Are you kidding me? That was the New England Patriots. Of course, the first team to go 16-0 during the regular season. They averaged 37 points a game. Tom Brady at the point threw 50 TD passes that year. He was your MVP. It's the first time that a guy had ever thrown for 50 touchdown passes. Randy Moss had a single season record, 23 touchdown receptions wow. that year. And they go into, of course, the Super Bowl against the Giants. They're favored by 12.5. They hadn't lost a football game ever. No team had ever done that outside, of course, the Miami Dolphins, who went 16-0. But this would have been set the standard higher because they played more games. And what happened? They lose that game 17-14. I you know, it's interesting, too, because I can remember, and obviously for entertainment purposes only, I enjoy playing those games. Now we don't have to say that anymore. But do you know what they were against the spread the last 10 games of the season? And the spread
they had been all virtually flawless.
They were 3-7 against the spread.
Oh, is that right? Wow, yeah. I did not remember that.
Well, and that was the crazy thing because they would get up, you know, they were favored by 13.5, they'd win 20-10. There were a couple of games where they blew the doors off, but and that was one game where I'm thinking to myself, okay, this team's undefeated. They've got all the firepower they want. You almost felt like they could name their score. And I don't know what they did in second halves of games in that 10-game jump because the spreads were not that high. I think the closest spread they had all year long was at Indianapolis. I think they were like a 6.5-point favorite. So I went back and looked, and I was telling you, I just love doing prep for the show. I went back and looked last night just to see, because normally you don't set spreads. They don't increase like that unless, of course, you're covering the spread. They were 3-7 and, of course, did not cover that 12.5 spread against the New York Giants in the Super Bowl. But I'm thinking to myself, that has got to be one of the biggest choke jobs when you're talking about Tom Brady, who's won 7 Super Bowls. He easily should have won 8. And that would have been something that no other football player would have done. 50 touchdown passes in 1 year. To go undefeated in the National Football League is unbelievably difficult because you're talking about great players on both sides of the ball. But that particular year, I have to say that's probably my biggest joke. All right, you got one more. What you got?
Yeah, that was the game with the infamous Eli Manning to Tyree, yes. The receiver who caught the ball against his helmet that kept the drive alive on a fourth down play. So it was just not meant to be. And the Miami Dolphins from 72, Tony, were able to pop their champagne on the evening of the Super Bowl. They do it every year as soon as the last team is not going to be undefeated. Yep. So there's not a whole lot of those guys left, but they're still popping champagne bottles.
Indeed.
My last one, I think I'm going to give it to a city, which is kind of a stretch, maybe a little bit. But I think this city, which I had a lot of familiarity with a kid because I grew up kind of in this area. The city is Baltimore, Maryland. And all apologies to my good friend, the legend, the famous caller from the Paul Feinbaum show. The legend was a Baltimore guy and has lived the horror
that is so
of
typical.
1969. The year was 1969, Tony. The place was the Super Bowl in Miami. The Baltimore Colts, 13-1 on the year, a 19-point favorite over the looked-down-upon AFL representative, the New York Football Jets, under Joe Willie Namath from the University of Alabama and Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. You can't make this stuff up. Joe Namath even gave them the ultimate locker room hang up when he sat on a chaise lounge by a pool in Miami, shirtless in his shorts, and declared, "We will win, I guarantee it," on the cover of Sports Illustrated, probably the most famous cover in the history of that publication. And damn if the Jets didn't do it. A 19-point underdog. They end up beating the Colts in that game and ruining their season. One of the most shocking things that really led to the acceleration of the merger, as the AFL had proved its credibility then and became part of the NFL as a result. But that was a terrible choke for Baltimore. But then it got worse, because in the summer, the Baltimore Orioles were the absolute dominant force in Major League Baseball. Tony, they're the only team to this day that ever had four 20-game winners on the same staff.
Wow.
Dave McNally, Mike Cuellar, Jim Palmer, and Pat Dobson all won more than 20 games that year. They had Frank Robinson. They had Brooks Robinson, both Hall of Famers. They had Boog Powell and Paul Blair and all these great players. They won something ridiculous like 118 games. They were just a juggernaut. And who did they play in the 1969 World Series? The morbid expansion in the early 60s, record-setting for losses, New York Mets, the Miracle Mets. And in that World Series, Baltimore Orioles, prohibitive favorites, lose to the Mets in six games. And unbelievably, the New York Mets and New York Jets, the two Queens-based teams, completely obscure underdogs, beat both of the juggernaut teams from Baltimore in the same season and cost them championships, and I think ruined the psyche of that city forever. They no longer have the Colts now, who are in Indianapolis, and the Orioles have been awful ever since. So and Baltimore now is one of the most crime-ridden, problematic cities in our country. I attribute it to that year in 1969, where everything went south with two of the biggest sports chokes in tandem of all time.
I love that. All right, my final choke. I'm going off the sports platform here. Sometimes, Kip, you can make your own choke, but sometimes you can make your own choke and you don't really actually think you're making your own choke. You don't even realize why things are happening around you. And I don't know if that's a good thing or bad thing. So I'm driving up to Memphis last Wednesday night to see the Memphis Grizzlies take on the LA Lakers. I wanted to see LeBron James play one time in flesh. And by the way, it's amazing. If you watch the NBA on television, to see it in person, it just doesn't do any justice when you watch it on television. It really doesn't. And so I'm sitting there watching LeBron James. I'm thinking, this is an amazing thing. And by the way, the Lakers got just absolutely roughshod. They got killed, but of course they won the series. So I'm driving into Memphis, and I don't go to Memphis very often, but I-22, man, straight shot, 3.5 hours.
That's so good.
Yeah, and you're pulling in, you're seeing signs for St. Jude's Research Hospital. You see signs all the time for that. And you're seeing the Stacks of Wax Museum. You're seeing signs for Graceland. I'm thinking to myself, is this the real Graceland? And I'm thinking, oh, that's right. We're in Memphis. This is where Graceland is, because yeah. I've never been to Graceland. And I'm seeing I'm seeing signs for Sun Records, right? And so, and thank goodness I don't drink anymore, because then I'm down there on Beale Street. And by the way, take a deep breath on Beale Street. You'll get secondary smoke. You'll get high as a kite. It's amazing. I don't know if weed is legal in Memphis or on Beale Street or in Tennessee. The waft is wonderful. Anyway, so I'm down there, and right there in the corner of Beale, I see the Jerry Lee Lewis bar, you know, the restaurant and the bar, and of course his museum. Yep. I'm thinking, oh man, Jerry Lee Lewis. Wow. And I start going back and I'm start going through, and of course, Jerry Lee Lewis just passed away last year. And by the way, his wife, Myra Gay Brown, one of his wives, didn't even show up to his funeral because she had some animosity towards his, not first, not second, not third, not fourth, not fifth, not sixth, but his seventh wife. Jerry Lee Lewis, of course, married seven times. Two times he was married while he was still married to someone else. And one time his seventh wife was actually the former wife of his wife's brother. Do I need to tell you what I just said again? His wife's brother's ex-wife, he married his seventh wife. So 1957, 1958, 1959, Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley are friends. And they're both working at a Sun Records in Memphis. And Jerry Lee Lewis He come out with a whole lot of shaking going on. Great Balls of Fire, 1958. Fools Like Me, Breathless, High School Confidential. I mean, he was huge, right? So all of a sudden, Elvis Presley goes into the service. And so this is Jerry Lee Lewis's opportunity to not only take away the rock and roll king. Jerry Lee Lewis had a great opportunity to be the king of rock and roll. We know who Elvis Presley is, but switch the tables. Elvis Presley would have been Jerry Lee Lewis, and Jerry Lee Lewis would have been Elvis Presley.
Wow.
So in order to push that, he decides that he's going to go over to the UK and do a tour. Now, over in the UK, they love some Jerry Lee Lewis. And again, Great Balls of Fire had just come out. Whole lot of shaking going on was the number one. I mean, he was huge, right? And since Elvis Presley couldn't make any new music, we didn't know how long he was going to be gone. This was his opportunity to take it by the neck and roll with it. Well, just about 4 months before he goes to the UK for this big tour, which, by the way, he was going to be making $10,000 a show. And he could have had as many shows as he wanted to. It was a situation where he'd say, I'd like to do 3 shows today. And they were going to pay him $10,000 for every appearance he had. That comes out to about $125,000 a night in today's money. So we're talking big time bucks. He ends up marrying his first cousin, Myra Gay Brown. Now, they were married 13 years. She, of course, was 13 at the time. He was 22. And it wasn't his first marriage, by the way. He goes up to her and says, would you like to go to Dairy Queen? They got root beer floats at Dairy Queen, which are unbelievable. Well, about 15 minutes later, she was married. She had no clue. She said, I have to be the only person in the world that had a surprise wedding. And it's one thing to have a surprise proposal, like you're really surprised it's coming out of left field that someone says, will you marry me? She said, I was actually married and didn't even know it was happening at the time. Wow. She said that she was the organizer. She was the mature one in the relationship, despite the fact that he was 9 years older. He was sitting there just chewing gum and getting drunk, and she was the one running all the books and making sure all the shows were going well and everything else. And again, she was only 13 years of age. Well, there was this guy who was a British journalist named Ray Berry over in the UK, and she gets off the plane with Jerry Lee Lewis, and no one knows who this woman is because they just got married 3 or 4 months before, and he said, who are you? Well, she wasn't told what not to say, what to say. She said, I'm Jerry Lee Lewis's wife. Oh. And he's like, really? And she's like, yeah, we just got married about 3 or 4 months ago. And so, of course, can you imagine what social media and what journalism was like in 1958, 1959, as opposed to 2023, how fast we dig? Well, believe it or not, within about 3 or 4 days, they found out about it in the UK, and they've kind of got some of the same moralistic views we have here in the United States. They're like, first of all, you're 22 and you married a 13-year-old, which, by the way, they went to Mississippi to do, and you only had to be 12 to be married in Mississippi. I don't know what the law is now.
Oh, my goodness.
So legally, he was on the get-go, but she was a first cousin, and he was already married to somebody else when he got married. Oh. So he remarried her when they got back to the United States. But by the time he had gotten back, the choke job was on. He had lost his record deal. He had lost his concert tour. He went from making 10 grand a night to making 250 bucks a night in bars. He lost his radio presence and he lost his career, and it just absolutely fell apart. And what the amazing thing is he came back, I think 1968, 69, because it takes some time like that to kind of let things settle down a little bit. And he actually became somewhat of a country music star. He had a couple of hits on the country media. But Jerry Lee Lewis had an opportunity at that point in time, and Elvis Presley was off doing his own thing. He was at the war, or he was in the service, and he had a chance to go to the UK and get this worldwide following, and it was all set up so beautifully for him to be the king of rock and roll, and he choked it away because he married his 13-year-old. I will bring up a little caveat to this story. I could do an entire show on Jerry Lee Lewis because his life was miraculous. It was amazing. Some of the crazy stuff he did. He accidentally shot one of his players by shooting a Coke bottle in one of his hotel rooms. He showed up at Elvis's Graceland one night. Elvis like come up to the house. He showed up, hit a tree outside Graceland. A gun went off there. And of course security came out. Elvis had Jerry Lee Lewis actually arrested on his property. And of course, Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley had a falling out there. But at the time that Jerry Lee Lewis, I don't know why people know this. At the time Jerry Lee Lewis married his cousin, Myra Gay Brown, at the age of 13, Elvis Presley was dating a 14-year-old Priscilla Presley, and he was also 22 years of age at that time. See how this choke job should have happened a little bit? Elvis kind of laid back a little bit. He was like, hey, this probably isn't too cool. But the funny thing is, till his dying day, he never realized the choke. Jerry Lee Lewis said, listen, if you love somebody and you want to spend your life with somebody, you marry them. And I did. And what's the problem? What's the big deal? And even Elvis said, hey, listen, you know, he loves her. And if he loves her and they want to get married, then so be it. They did get married again, by the way, after he got divorced to his third wife. But I'm going to say that's the biggest choke job. Jerry Lee Lewis could have had a totally different trajectory in his career when it comes to rock and roll. And the fact that actually he saved it was pretty miraculous in and of itself. It really was. So that's my final choke job.
That's awesome. That's a great one. It's funny because one of the ones I was thinking about using was Pete Best, the original drummer for the Beatles.
Yes.
Not a good move by Pete to bow out there.
No. And I was thinking about Scotty Norwood, the 47 yard he missed, and of course the four Super Bowls, the Buffalo Bills. But I never felt like the Buffalo Bills were even going to compete in any of those four. The AFC was just so off. And the other one you brought up, and I didn't even think about that, but would you say that Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential run was a choke job?
Massive choke, because she's so arrogant, and they made terrible mistakes, really lousy campaign strategy, and did not see the Trump wave coming. So absolutely a choke for
sure. She didn't go on the road the last 2 months. She just stayed at home and just thought the Democrats are going to win. And that was her last shot. Hey, great show, man. Great show. Love talking about this. The Kiefer and Curry Show, of course, you can hear it at least 5 days a week on the TKR app, Tony Curry Radio. Download that TKR app. Get after it. Of course, go check us out on our podcast. You can go back and listen to any of our previous shows. And we'd love to hear from you, info@TonyCurryRadio.net. You've got any comments or maybe you're some choke jobs from this week, feel free to fill it up. Go to info@TonyCurryRadio.net, and we're more than happy to go ahead and mention those on shows that are coming up here soon. It's your pick next week, my man. I'm looking forward to hearing what you got.
All right. Can't wait.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.